That's New York.
Great. I'm all set.
Okay, hello. Yep, he's all set. So the next step? Okay, I've got a microphone in front of me. All right, we're starting then. I don't think so. It's possible, but the name sounds vaguely familiar. Are these David's original tapes? You finally got those. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I haven't heard those. I was aware that he was taping, but he and David didn't wind up getting along so well, I think. Yeah. Because Gene was there, and he was a photographer. I had no idea he was a famous photographer, and he kind of lurked around, so he was taping also. And he invited me down to his studio one night, showed me some pictures, and finally David told me, oh, yeah, he's, you know, a really good photographer, so... Around that time, I think the loft was getting quiet, but he, from what David said, he had hours and hours of tape. No, they could have been around, and there was so much stuff on the floor that you wouldn't see them. You know, it was an artist studio, so yeah. Oh, yeah, it's like, it's memorized. It was the corner of 6th Avenue and 28th Street. It was on 6th Avenue, about two doors north of 28th Street. And it was next to some kind of business, fruits and vegetables or something like that. And you opened the door, and there was kind of a semi-rickety flight of stairs, and it went up and up. So the first flight was a loft, and that's what Gene eventually had. And I think the second flight was Dick Carey, and you're still going up the stairs, then Hall Overton, and then the top floor was David. And you walked in, and the loft spread out to both to the right and left and forward. And if you turn right, you would run into a living area and a heavy painting area. Straight ahead was a wall with space, a piano over there too, so there was lots of room. And to your left would be more paintings and more room. So we had a combination of things to look at and things to hear. In very good shape. It was an artist's loft, so it was not clean and neat. You wouldn't expect that. One of my favorite stories about David, he was going to get married to, I think, somebody, a rich lady somewhere. And so he'd gone to Brooks Brothers to get a suit, and a few of us were hanging around the loft drinking and talking. And David came back, and it took him about a half an hour to get paint on the suit and get it, worn. So he felt comfortable, because he looked really silly in new clothes, because he was a painter, and he looked like a painter. So, I do, oh yeah, it was silly, so he had to get it worn right away. He might have had a hole in the pants, too. Yeah. It could have been. He had me down, and he'd taken some pictures of 6th Avenue during the rain, and he was very proud of them. They turned out to be a famous set of pictures, but I thought, well, they're nice pictures of 6th Avenue. But the place was really, it was a smaller loft, and it was crowded with stuff. So he was kind of a spooky man, He didn't say much, and he kind of lurked, as I said, around. I was in Boston quite a bit when I was around 22 or 23, either working with Teddy Charles, Stan Getz, or somebody, and playing Storyville a lot, or the Hi-Hat, I think it was called. And so David came down and introduced himself, and I went to his loft, and then I had dinner, had some octopus for the first and only time in my life, in another painter's loft, which was quite good. But I remembered David, of course, and I liked his paintings very much. I was just getting used to having pictures around. So that connection was established, and I would see him when I went to Boston. And then shortly after that, I think he began to move to New York. And in history, I never asked him, but history told me that he rented this whole thing for about $150 a month or $125. So he had the loft, and we stayed in contact. And David didn't have a lot of money, so I would take him to jazz clubs. We'd go out and drink and have dinner and hear music. So we became very close friends. And often I'd be at the loft, just he and I talking. And one night he showed me all his sketchbooks from Boston on. And I realized that abstract expressionist painters were very good drawers. He showed me his early drawings and his sketchwork of bodywork. And so I learned a lot from him about looking. And maybe he learned something about listening from me. I hope so. Yeah, for me it was. I didn't know anything about it. So especially with David's work, I was getting to know his work really well, and de Kooning, some people would drop around. And I liked what I saw so much, and I didn't know that it came from very strict academic background. So that surprised me. In a way, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I think probably the first contact was playing music. If I recall, I probably went to the loft to see it and talk to Dave. And then he got a piano, and so we started to play. Often at his behest, you know, we'd set a date to play. It was sometimes 4 and 5 nights a week. Or we could call him if we were on Saturday night and nothing to do and wanting to play. And he was usually home. So it was fine with him. So it was a combination of invites, so to speak, yeah. There was later on in the 60s what they call a loft scene, which was more the avant-garde. And that is what most people think of as a loft scene. Well, it would be, you know, Sam Rivers or whoever was playing then. And this was, I think, one of a kind to me. I didn't go to many others. I went to Tristano's studio once to see what it was like, and it was a little too quiet for me. But at David's, it was such a nice combination of people, and you were invited as long as you could play, and you were disinvited if you couldn't play. But the atmosphere was really loose, and a lot of drinking and smoking going on. And it was just, hard to put, a lively artistic environment. And that was unusual in the places that I saw. They were either quiet, too quiet for me, or they had an agenda. You know, you had to play outside of the music or avant-garde or whatever it was called. And we were within the framework, but we were very free. Well, I'm told that one night an alto player showed up, and he was all over the place, not good, and shouldn't have been there, so I disinvited him. I asked him to leave. Normally, people would get a draft if they, you know, the level was so high that if you didn't play well, it was apparent, and you can get a lot done by some looks and play something too fast or too slow, whatever. But they just normally wouldn't come. A lot of people were there. I missed Miles was there some. I missed that. And Salvador Dali, I understand, was there a couple of times. Happily, I missed that. But the painters would hang out. De Kooning and that bunch would be there a lot. And that was nice because we knew who they were and they liked us. And it was a wonderful, for me, a wonderful atmosphere because there were people that I admired greatly listening to stuff that they admired greatly. Yeah, I heard about that later, yeah. Oh, players, yeah. They were the standard, you know, Lee Konitz, Warren Marsh, Zoot, Mulligan, Art Farmer. They were the normal musicians. That was not a high-level group to us. That was who we played with. Oh, yeah, well, we had our own standards, and we didn't walk around saying we're a high-level group. We sort of understood that we were adjudged to be good, and we were. We knew that. So if somebody came and didn't make it, that's as long as there has been music, and it's much like sport. You can't fake it. So if you don't do it well, then you know it, or if you don't know it, then you're reminded that you're not up to what we need, so you should be quiet. Yeah, Monk and I were friends, and he was downstairs working with Hal Overton on the, I think, Town Hall concert and the European trip. Hal wrote some arrangements of his music, so we'd hear them rehearsing sometimes. Yeah. Oh, I loved Monk. We got to be friends in Paris when I went over with Mulligan in 54, and we stayed friends. And I'll tell you a funny story. We became friendly in Paris, went out and played every night, and then we had to stop because the nightclub was advertising us. And Mulligan's wife didn't want us to be there anyway. She was kind of the business manager. So I came back. I know Monk enjoyed playing with Red Mitchell and Frank Isola and I. And I had a concert at Carnegie Hall with Getz, and I woke up, I was really hungover, I had the flu, really felt bad. So I went in the back, the old staircase you used to climb in the back of Carnegie Hall, and Monk was waiting for me. And I walked up the stairs, and he grabbed me and gave me a huge bear hug, and I guess I stiffened. I hadn't been hugged by many people of either sex. So he really gave me a whopper, and then he kind of drew back and said, "Well, I see you're your own man." And then he wanted me to go to the men's room, and I was afraid he wanted me to do some junk. He wanted just to smoke some dope. So we had kind of a rocky beginning to what was a nice friendship. But he forgave me my vicissitudes, and we really liked each other. Yeah. Monk was one of the first to come to a record date, and the band would say, "Where's the music?" He said, "My briefcase. Here's the first tune." And he would teach them by rote the music. In that way, you learn it. You don't learn much from reading something off paper. You have to, after you see the paper, then you have to internalize it, make it part of you, and then you have to bring it back to the surface, and what the composer would like you to do with it becomes part of your response. And then part of your response, and while you're there, is how you view it, too. So Monk was what appeared to be a fairly fractious personality. He was very smart and very organized, and so was his wife, Nellie. And he was very serious about what he did. You know, he had fun with it, but you had to be serious to get it right so you could have fun with it. So he'd no halfway measures with Theo. He was really serious. Yeah, you had to learn it and really learn it that way. As if we'd learn a play the same way, I guess, you would really know what the character said because you had to slowly learn it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think much the same. Teddy was one of my employers when I first got to New York. I had two steady employers. One was Bob Maltz and Stuyvesant Casino, which was Thursday nights on the East Side, where I played piano, sometimes trombone, had a great wealth of people, Buck Clayton, Coleman Hawkins, Ben Webster, really a panoply of the older players. And that was a great education for me and very homey. And the other was Teddy Charles. We played one night a week midtown with Charlie Mingus and Al Levitt. And that was a very free circumstance. So you were encouraged to be crazy. No, I don't. There could be, you know. We had so much fun there, sometimes too much fun, so the memory might be a little dim on some occasions. But I would take your word. Jesus. It could be sometimes a couple of times a week. We were all on the road sometimes. And I don't know, a lot. It was a home, you know. It was my apartment, and then there was the loft, and then there were our Midtown bars, Junior's, the Jim and Andy's. So those were kind of the three places that were familiar. And it's hard to, you know, this late date to quantify how many days, because the days didn't matter much then. Yeah, oh yeah, sure. Fairly well, yeah. Not as well as some of his students, but I knew him, and we had sort of a mutually respectful friendship. We didn't do much together. There wasn't much we could do if I didn't study with him. But I liked him a lot, and we liked each other and respected each other. So you had a lot of friends then that were your peers that you maybe didn't know so well, but you were kind of distanced by mutual respect. So you didn't need to talk over things, you know, like, how do you do that, or, excuse me, why do you do this? You accepted what was done, and you either liked it or you didn't, so they became favorites or not so important. Yeah, he was. He had a very fine mind, and it didn't interfere with his playing or his good times. So, yeah. There is a fine line sometimes between intellect and enjoyment in jazz music, I think. So if you can merge the two, where the intellect becomes whoopee, you know, then I think you've reached a good point. Much like Lee Konitz is playing, or Warren Marsh. They had all kinds of control, allegedly, and they're both technicians supreme, but yet they could do anything or nothing. So they had a great choice. Yeah, we were getting probably a little darker, even in our field, which was more or less compared to Cecil Taylor and Ornette. We were conservative or traditional, whichever. But within the traditional mold, you could make incremental improvements. My life was always looking for the right wrong note, as Nat Hentoff said. So I was concerned with improving my own vocabulary, as I am still. Some people just were repeaters, and they faded out very quickly because nobody's interested in hearing your version of somebody else. And I think Tristana was an early, very important part of this whole scene. Charlie Parker came to Lenny, and he was getting really upset because everybody played like him, and that's destructive. And he and Lenny wanted to do some things and try to figure out a way to make a music that young people couldn't just copy note for note. They'd have to learn how the music really went, and then they should have their own version of that, their own personal version. And teaching is still the same way. I've got to now deprogram Coltrane tenor players, because that's I'm amazed at what, you know, these guys can learn. But one of my pianists in Holland, we had Michael Brecker for a guest with my New Art Orchestra in Hamburg, and he played beautifully, and my pianist said, how do those guys remember all that stuff? I thought that was a very plain-pointed statement. With all due respect, Michael was a wonderful man and a great saxophone player, and he was one of the great continuations of Coltrane. But I kind of grew up with Coltrane. I knew John when he didn't play very well with Miles, and then we were working opposite when I was playing with Jufri. We worked opposite Miles and Bill Evans and Coltrane, and he had just stopped drinking and was starting to practice. So I was around for the shift in his attitude and his playing. So when you see somebody grow up, you don't necessarily hang on to every word they're saying. So when he arrived at a certain point, he became canon, and people had to play like him. It was like Charlie Parker earlier. And nobody could play like Dizzy, so nobody copped Dizzy. But Miles, they could, so a lot of people played like Miles. Not that people copied who they could copy, but, Bud Powell was a huge influence, and there were people that you couldn't copy, and Dizzy was one. You just couldn't get what he had because he was such a brilliant musician in every way, and also such a grand human being that you couldn't get him. Me. Yeah. Sure. Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I told Lethanet one time, he asked me something about my playing. I said, well, my life is a search for the right wrong note, which is still true, I think. Yeah, bless him. Yeah. Who was he? Yeah, he could have been there, and there were people around that we just didn't bother with, to put it bluntly, that they weren't musicians, or we weren't told by David, that's Gene Smith, he takes pictures, okay. But anybody else, you know, if he's a lawyer or whatever he is, it didn't pass. So. Once in a while, yeah. And Billy and I were really good friends then, and I thought he was... In 1959, I spent the whole year very close to him, and I thought he was the end of the world. It didn't get any better than that for me at that time. Yeah. Ronnie was kind of a house drummer. He was nice, good drummer, but not an Elvin Jones or a Mel Lewis. You know, nobody that would stick to your skin. Oh yeah, fine guy, good drummer. Yeah. It could have been, yeah. Probably in some instances. I didn't feel too often in David's place that we were developing jazz. We would shudder if you said that, you know, like where the awful question, where do you think jazz is going? You know, down 48th Street to Jim and Andy's, you know, the standard answer. But maybe later in the 60s, in the more avant-garde, well, not the more, the avant-garde lofts, for want of a better term, they were consciously trying to break models and do something new. And we were not. I think we basically wanted to swing and have fun and play well. And since we normally played well anyway, it was trying to play the best that we could play or to enjoy what we did. And it's when people hear that you like to listen to yourself, well, why else would you play? You know, if you didn't like what you did, we'd be tortured to listen to yourself play. So you enjoy what you do, and you want to do it more and do it better, and the act of doing is satisfactory, and especially if you're physically and psychologically in a good mood, assisted sometimes by outward, by drugs and such, then you really can listen to yourself and you enjoy it. And I think that what transpired as far as advancing the music would be more natural and more naturally occurring, and not conscious that we'll try to see if this will work, what we just wanted to play. And out of these things came, Jimmy Rainey. I first got aware that Jimmy played an arch form for a solo, and Jim Hall was new in town then. And I loved Rainey, and he got to, you know, really love Rainey also. Rainey was one of the best improvisers then on any side of the bridge. And being around him, you learned how to make a long solo work. It wasn't talked about, but Hall and I would talk about it away from the loft. Say, how does he do that? It's like an arch form. He just makes a solo that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it's amazing. But I don't think we were, blowing up buildings or anything like that. Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. When you're playing with somebody like Lee Konitz, to me, he's one of the best improvisers that's lived. And after Lee plays, you're challenged. Yeah. So you have to go deep inside yourself. You can't play something that you know too well because it just sounds silly. So when anybody plays some music that is above you, and Lee is still above me as an improviser, then you try to get up and reach up and see if you can somehow get a piece of that and enjoy some of the music that he's playing and take a piece for yourself and see what you can do with it. So it's, a constant process of education, it should be. Well, yeah, I think that some people don't acknowledge this, but jazz is competitive, and there's brotherhood and all that. But you get on the bandstand, you don't want to play worse than somebody. I tell my students, your aim is not to go down to the Village Vanguard and play bad for a first set. You want to go down and kill for the first set. You want to be the best thing in the world, which is, of course, an idiotic ambition, but that's that crazy little light inside that makes us do all this stuff. I don't get up in the morning and say, I'm going to write a piece that will make Stravinsky's ghost blush. I try to write something that is okay for me and that works, and my taste is pretty rough. So I'm a hard listener, and if I can get past all my guards and sensors, then maybe I've gotten something worthwhile. And I think it's those guards and sensors you build up playing when you're playing with people who are superior. One of the saddest things that's happened that can happen when you grow older, when you're younger, you're the youngest on the bandstand and not the best. Attrition and so on, commercial circumstances, 40 years later makes you playing the best, and you're the oldest on the bandstand, so you're usually the band leader. And that's not so good because you should have somebody always to challenge you and compete with you to play well. I think so. That's why I enjoyed playing with Mulligan and he me. And I think part of the relationship with Getz was successful that way because he could do so much I couldn't, yet I thought about some things that he hadn't thought about. So there was the mutual respect based that way. And Clark Terry and I were just like two old shoes. We just fit together so well personally and musically that it was like having another family member. But I know with Mulligan that was... there was a lot of mutual respect gained on him meeting somebody who knew enough music that I could understand what he did and react to it, not only on playing, but on paper, too. So... Yeah. Normally, it would be a special night. When you're working, then you're working till 4 o'clock in the morning. And if you, when you're on the road, you try to go out and play when you're younger. But I think when you're working in New York, you either go home or try to get married. And those are the two honorable pursuits that take care after work. So. A little bit, yeah. I was interested, but not really fascinated. I was interested in Monk, and with all due respect to what was done with the music, I would rather hear, it was like, it was the second step on Monk's music, and I would rather hear the first step, which is Monk playing his music. And I think there's so much you could do with that. I know we did a, when I was in California doing studio work, Oliver Nelson had a big band with Monk, and that was not thought of very well afterward. When it happened, we all just did the dates. And it was nice to see Monk in California or anywhere. But Monk was sort of lost, and he walked over and said, "You got any solos?" I said, "No." He said, "Shit." So nobody was too delighted. That was once again trying to gild Monk when he didn't need it. I think that can happen to the detriment of some very singular and fine artists. Yeah, they don't need it, you know. It's trying to put something in Miro that moves, you know, to put some Rauschenberg on Miro. It wouldn't work so well. Sure, yeah. It could have been, yeah. It could have been. He worked with Clark Terry and I some, and very good bass player. So he could have been around. No. I think anything that gives you a home in New York, especially your first 10 or 20 years. I know when I first came to New York, I carried a ticket to Kansas City around in my pocket for about 2 years. Excuse me. So we had homes. I was talking to my wife about that last night. Like Charlie's Tavern at first, then Junior's, and then finally Jim and Andy's. Aside from our physical home, that became a necessity because by that time we were doing studio work, which meant we played a lot of stuff we didn't really like or believe. And we'd go there to have a jazz social life, if you want to put it that way. So if there hadn't been a loft, I would have missed it greatly, I think. I would have missed knowing Dave, and I would have missed knowing about his painting and knowing how he painted and how he got there from where he was. And I would have missed having a home because I don't know, when he left for the summer, he'd give me keys to the loft to check on things. And water plants. So we were really close that way, and it was another home. You know, it didn't matter some, excuse me, it didn't matter sometimes whether we were going to play or not. I could just drop by, call, and he could come by my house the same way. So I think that if you had several homes like that in New York, you were a wealthy man, where you were welcome and things were warm and there were things interesting to look at, interesting to hear, interesting things to talk about. And that's not common. In California, when I lived in L.A. for 10 years, there was no place to go. Not a place. People went home to their castles. And there was no place to hang out, no place to get feeling too good at. No, you know, it was just, it was its own valence. And New York, of course, is to me the right picture. It was then, anyway. You couldn't walk down the street without seeing poor people, and you weren't shielded from the vicissitudes of normal city life. You were right in the middle of it, so you never got too high and mighty, and hopefully you never got too low. Often you'd see a friend on the street begging. First time I saw Miles, in 1954, Mulligan and I left Basin Street West, and there was Miles sitting on a trumpet case, which I think he'd borrowed or stolen, asking for money. You know, a year later, Miles had his act together and was, you know, doing it, but he was in a bad place then, and it was a public bad place. And when people were in trouble in New York, it would be a public display of trouble. In California, you could hide a lot. You know, you could stay home and be in the wasteland. But in New York, you couldn't. So New York, I thought, you know, it says truth. It did then, I hope it still does. But yes, I think that I needed David's loft on a variety of levels. I think we all did. Well, we all did studio work, you know, whether you're working with Mulligan or Sonny Rollins or what. You'd see Jim Hall on the date or Jimmy Rainey or the Elvins. So we had to earn extra money, or we wanted to, whichever it was. And the quality of the commercial business then was quite good. You had Ralph Burns writing for you or Al Cohn. And moving to California when the business did, the level was still very high. I did a lot of movie work. And you're sitting with the best musicians in the world, probably. And still, it's, it's very boring. And it's not you. It's not what you do. It's not what you wanted to do when you were 10 years old. So there's a terrible pull there. You have to either adjust or you try to drug or drink it through. And that way doesn't work because that's the way I tried. So you have to adjust, and I couldn't do that. Well, I'm delighted that there's some interest in The Loft, you know, and David, you know. I heard something about that, yeah. Is his daughter involved at all? David. Okay, it might be nice to let her know, because she had a pretty rough life. And I know I did a benefit concert for her about 2 or 3 years ago in Boston. And we got to be nice friends, and we have a picture on her on the website together, but she's a nice lady with, I think, could use inclusion rather than exclusion. Yeah. Okay, well, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Sometime. I'm not sure quite when. I would like that. Well, send me an email at brookmeyer@aol.com and we'll try to set up something. Okay, you've been a pleasure. Okay, bye. Okay, yeah, she was nice. Very informative. Mm-hmm. Happy to be doing.